It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
Welcome, I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. And today's conversation is going to focus on a collaboration between an artist and a developmental psychologist on a new exhibit that is called Into a Study. And we're going to explore ways in which paintings can also double as an experiment, and we'll hear from Jennifer Drake about that, and how we perceive and understand art. And we also have with us artist Paul Roots. And I'm excited to have both of you here. This is great. So a collaboration between a developmental psychologist and an artist. It sounds like it's made perfectly for us to talk about. So Jen, can I start with you just for a second? What is a developmental psychologist, in case people don't know?
Of course. So I study children's development. Often when people think of a psychologist, they think of, you know, a clinical or a therapist, a clinical psychologist. But I study children's development, and I specifically focus on children's drawing development, as well as their emotional well-being. So looking at how they regulate their emotions, how they understand emotions, but primarily looking at drawing development. And I look from birth into, I guess, young adulthood.
Wow. And does that dovetail then somewhat with art therapy as well, or does it feed to that?
It does not. No, okay. But my work does, I guess it kind of runs parallel to art therapy. So okay. I do look at, in a separate line, unrelated to the work that I've done with Paul, I look at how children use drawing to regulate their emotions. But these are working with children outside of a clinical setting, not looking at art therapy, of course, which is a dialogue between patient and therapist. It's done over many sessions. But my work is looking both with children and adults, how a single session of drawing improves mood.
Wow, that's really interesting. And Paul, your work, when I look at the website, and I'll refer people to it from our website, but it's pretty amazing. It involves humans in motion. And they're really in motion. And you even said something when you paint still lives or do that work, that you still have things in motion, not just people. Can you describe your work a little bit?
Oh, yeah. First of all, thanks for having us. I come from dance as sort of a main way of having an impact in the world, and the way that I think about how I engage with the world. I think of us all as basically dancers. And I think it's important to, as I make still objects, think about how we're still moving when we see them, you know, and it can be everything from the fact that even if you try to stare at something as much as you possibly can, right, your eyes are still making those little saccades, those little adjustments, and your heart is beating. But also, of course, there's a difference between seeing a painting from a range of 50 feet and then 3 feet. Or from the side and from the front, and there's opportunity to play with all that, right? So especially lately, if I'm doing a picture, yeah, still life, you know, a tree even, I can do that in, say, bas relief. I can mess around with the ways that matte versus gloss forms happen, so that your movement, say, across the room, does animate that picture, makes it more lively. And I like to think about us all as moving viewers, no matter what I, you know, paint or install.
Well, and you know, your kind of bringing dance to it does give a really different perspective. When I think about dancers, and I have several friends that are really great choreographers, and they really do lay out things and see depth. And that thing, sometimes from the stage, you don't see as much unless it's a very raked or, you know, slanted stage. But when they're thinking, they are thinking about position. And so it sounds like that makes its way over into your art.
Yeah, and just like in dance, you know, when you're choreographing something, it's just a lot of practicalities after a while, right? We need to allow the dancer to get from here to there in this much time. Or, you know, are we able to do this lift under these conditions? Is it safe? And so, yeah, I'm thinking like that when I have models in the room. I mean, often I don't even know. I just start choreographing on them, you know, ooh, that was good, but do it upside down or backwards or, you know, something like that. And that's how I generate ideas. Just working with live people a lot like dancers do.
Yeah, and that makes your art really, really difficult because they're in motion, right? I mean, the most difficult thing I think of naturalists is being able to capture a bird in motion, or you're talking about humans in motion.
Yeah, what does a bird in motion really look like? And how can you get at that without, say, leaning on photography? You know, we're so steeped in photography, but there are all these other ways of picturing that. I really enjoy that kind of experimentation. And I look for a challenge, you know, if I'm painting on my back while looking up at somebody, or, you know, whatever other strange thing I can come up with, like maybe getting in cahoots with a developmental psychologist and having, you know, a massive challenge of paintings to do for the project we just did.
So speaking of that, both Jen and Paul, can you describe what Intuos Study is?
Who's going first, Jen?
I can start. So we're looking at how, through a series of artworks that are in a gallery setting, how people perceive and understand different works of art. And we're including both abstract and representational works. And so we're inviting, viewers as they come into the gallery study to, you know, scan a QR code and to go through a series of questions as they view each painting. So we're really looking at that, looking at how people understand and perceive art.
Wow. So it really is a research study as well.
Yes. No, it really is a research study. Yes. Wow. So we have, you know, a whole survey that we have, you know, a lot of, you know, Paul and I have talked a lot about different factors. We have different pathways that participants go through, so we can kind of eliminate whether looking at certain paintings in a certain order. So there are a lot of, it is really an experimental study that's now put into a gallery setting, which is quite new and novel from a psychology standpoint.
Paul?
I titled it Into a Study on Purpose. You're literally walking into a scientific study. So just like the way that, you know, that sort of art gallery thing is, okay, this is art, right? We're walking into an art circumstance. That's assumed, right, as you walk into the gallery, no matter what the installation is, you know? In this case, we have, the way I see it is, I'm embracing science's strictures, you know, the way that it's better for Jen if no one has seen the paintings ahead of time. It's better if we aren't, she had me go through a bunch of qualifications, you know, to become a legitimate researcher.
Well, that's by the university, but not me.
Right.
Well, but that's right. So she was a wonderful... Jen handles logistics. She's an absolute champ. And so we have all the paperwork, you know. But so it really is, the way I look at it is these paintings are framed by science. You're walking into the circumstances that is science. You know, as Jen said, you scan the QR code with your phone or the provided device, and you follow the directions, you know, consent. So you are aware that you're a subject, you know, and you're being led through this thing in this particular order. And it's been super interesting to talk to people after they go through it. One guy that pops into my mind is the reporter. There's a local, I'm in Portland, Oregon. There's a local reporter named Cor Harlan who does a morning show. And he actually did the study, and we weren't letting him do it on camera because we wanted everybody to, you know, of course, you know, we didn't want the paintings to be seen ahead of time and all that, but it was super interesting to talk to him afterwards because he's like, wow, you know, I realized some new things about myself. I realized that I like, you know, this sort of painting and not that kind. And that's part of the artistic project from my point of view.
Wow. And so
I'm sorry, I just wanted to add too, it's not just that, I wanted to add that it's, you know, we're going through an experiment as they view the paintings, but also how we set up the paintings is also was driven by kind of the research and the literature that's been done in the psychology of aesthetics. So even what paintings that Paul created, we had a specific question in mind. You know, we had specific parameters that he had to follow and kind of constrictions in his artwork that I'm sure he can talk about. But even how the, what we call a lot of like stimuli, the paintings were very specific in how they were designed for the experiment. So
I'm really curious, Jen, how did you choose Paul or vice versa?
I did not choose Paul. I mean, Paul contacted me, and so he can talk about that. But I'll just say from my standpoint, much of the work in the psychology of aesthetics, creativity in the arts has been done in a lab setting, especially aesthetics. Right. So we invite undergraduates into a lab setting. They view paintings on a computer screen. And so that the opportunity to look at something like an authentic setting, to have it in a gallery, and where an artist was willing to create these paintings specifically for the study, was just such a novel and exciting collaboration and opportunity for me. So when Paul contacted me, we met, and I just seized on the opportunity because I thought this was very exciting. So I can have Paul talk about, because I know he's had a journey before even, you know, meeting me about research and combining the arts and science, so.
It's true. There was quite a journey. let's see, to be brief. 10 years ago plus, I was doing a PhD at Purdue University in theory and cultural studies. My dissertation was on combat art from the Iraq War. I'm a Navy veteran as well as a former reporter for the Pentagon's press service. And I was super interested in how people were using different, different modes to communicate the combat action in Iraq. And I got frustrated with a lot of this sort of available theory on how to frame that, you know, meaning that post-structuralists and so on are, you know, we're going to go dive into how everyone has their own truth and everything's a text and so on. And I'm just like, yeah, but, you know, my friend Ron Winchester got killed on a bridge in Iraq. Like, can we start with that fact? And there wasn't a lot available on the humanities side. So what I found was, you know, a group actually out of the foreign languages department at Purdue, led by Howard Mansing and Paula Leverage. I just want to drop their names because they're fantastic. And they were looking at theory of mind, a bunch of different kinds of ways you could use scientific insights to read literature. And I started to see that all over dance, right? You know, your human bodies doing our things, as we just talked about. And then came, you know, a complete just change in my dissertation, you know, and as a subtext to that diss, I was like, wow, the arts and sciences should really be talking more. There's probably a lot, right? A lot of great stuff we could do. Fast forward several years to what, 2017. And I got into a strange situation where a painting of mine had to be two places at once, long story short, for contractual reasons. So I painted a copy. And there, you know, the two paintings unsold came back, and I got really interested in the idea of who could tell the difference. You know, were there certain people with certain training or certain talents who could see which one was painted first? And so I contacted some neuroscientists I'm friends with anyway, you know, from that Purdue world, and we threw together a study that was. It was like we made all the good mistakes when we put it on in 2018. We did things like we trained about a dozen people to take people one at a time through this series of seven pairs of paintings that I had painted, you know, and these are just a little off in this way, and those are just a little off in that way. And we did eye tracking. It was all very, it was a ton of data. There was a ton of variation, as we found out, in the ways that different people asked those questions. And so kind of came back with that data, as it turned out, a bit of a mess. And it was hard to find, you know, how to write, let's say, the results up. Then came COVID, which just blew that up, just shut it down. I had been working with the lab of Mandy Hampton Ray out of University of Pittsburgh. That lab usually studies stuttering. They study how people acquire language and why kids stutter. So this was a side project to them anyway, you know, and then with COVID, it was like, we just can't go on. So then I started contacting the people I was reading anyway, including Jen, who's done amazing work that I had read in the past. And I said so. And she said, well, that's really interesting what you're doing. We do want to take this out of our, you know, off the screen and out into the real world if we can, but I'm not going to touch eye tracking. And I said, that sounds good to me. So let's see what we can do. We went back to our corners, you know, reread a bunch of stuff that we had both, you know, and introduced each other, I think, to new things, sort of surveyed the, you know, what we know or don't know scientifically about how people view visual art, and, you know, kind of chose one brick, you know, to add to that wall and went from there. What else is important? I think it is enormously important to me as an artist that as we began to put together this thing, my process had to change. We both had to adjust a ton in order to get this thing produced. And we can talk about that in some depth if you want. But that, you know, the fact that I was super challenged and in directions I couldn't have predicted was really important as far as this collaboration success goes.
You know, this is really interesting because you guys took this out of, Jen, like you said, a research setting, and you entered into a public gallery.
Right, which does take a, wow, like, kind of like a leap of faith, right? Because you have this, like, well, we're looking at authentic setting, but you lose some of that control. That experimenters love that experimental control.
And I know.
And that's something that Paul and I had to really think through, you know, how are we going to have to lead people through the gallery? How are we going to set up the paintings?
Right. So my own experience is I've been a museum professional educator for a very long time and exhibit designer. And it is very difficult to do research when people have the ability to choose what they want to look at and when. And I see so many curators try to force somebody to go through linear kinds of things, and people just won't, even psychologically won't. They'll just jump to where they want to go, which I think is interesting. So you guys had that challenge of the visitor really wants to see something. And it, when they want to see it or pay attention, then maybe it might not be what you want to know right then. And so that is a real challenge.
Yes, definitely. We had, so we had 12 paintings in the gallery. And so I don't know if it was Paul or someone at the was it your idea, the arrows? We have two paths that people take. And so through this survey, we actually have small, very small thumbnails of each painting. And we have arrows that take them through the paintings. There's two paths, the randomly assigned, the red path or the green path. But I don't know, our experience, like I went to the opening of the gallery, people were really good about following the linear path. They didn't really seem to deviate. I don't know, Paul, if you have any other experiences, you know, kind of.
Well, I mean, yeah, the arrows, that came from the trial and error from before, you mm-hmm. know? I mean, we had made a bunch of mistakes. We didn't, you know, we just tried stuff and realized eventually that there was a better way to do it. So by the time I brought, you know, this thing to Jen, I had already thrown out several possible ways to do it, which was super helpful as far as our, you know, just our efficiency goes. We before we really opened it, I happened to have a 2-weekend open studios event, which we always do in the fall in Portland. And so I just used those 2 weekends to test the heck out of the thing, you know, and Jen's over in New York, right? So we're the first weekend, it's just continuous test texting and little changes, you know, throughout the entire protocol. And then by the second weekend, I don't think we made any changes. We were set.
But you had reported that some people had like strong reactions to the, I don't know if it was the arrows or just the idea of like having, it was optional. We made it very clear this is a voluntary study, but I know people had some strong reactions to the idea of combining the art with the experiment. I don't know if you want to talk about that too.
Oh yeah. And strong reactions in, you know, multiple directions, yeah. Right? So some people's reactions were Cora Harlan going, wow, you've totally changed my idea of what I like in a painting. And other people were saying, what are you doing making me do this? I don't want to have to look at the phone while I look at the thing. I don't, why, you know, what are you doing to me? And I also love the strictures of science under these conditions, because I'm not allowed to say what I'm up to. So it's super fun to just have them tell me what's wrong with me, and then, you know, ask some polite follow-up questions, and then vent to Jen and, you know, move on. Because I like having to play that different role as well, you know, from the usual. I think, you know, we tend to think of art as like, you know, the site for self-expression by the artist, you know? And in this case, that it can't help but leak out, right? I am making the paintings, but, you know, our process in doing them, we tried one time. All right, I'm going to tell this anecdote, Jen, the first painting. So, so we had done this thing, you know, we'd gone through all our reading. We had decided what questions we were going to try to answer. Jen had written up this just beautiful scaffolding, you know, for the study. And we set to work, you know, okay, first painting, here comes the model, I'm doing this thing. And about maybe I'm 2/3 of the way through it, I start sending photos to Jen, here's what I'm doing, you know? And she's like, well, how come it doesn't have this in it? And I was like, what do you mean?
I guess we can say, so it was supposed to be portraying something through the face, and it had no head.
It had no head. So Jen's like, where's the face? And I was like, you don't say face. And, you know, I'm holding up the little paragraph we had written of, you know, needs to have a body. I'm like, it's got a body. What? Yeah. So we start quoting Wittgenstein and Martha Graham and all sorts of stuff. We're going back and forth. And, you know, I totally lost that argument, you know, throw that painting out, start over.
I mean, so, and it was very hard because it was a beautiful painting too. It was really beautiful, and I know that, and I felt bad, but I know that also made me say, okay, we really need to have clear, like, operational definitions of things, and even within this research community, but then we're also like communicating, you know, kind of sometimes two different languages. And so it was like, oh, we have to be really clear about what we, you know, what I meant too. Yeah. Cause I was like, oh, bodies meant that I meant the entire body, not just the body.
Yeah, I was like, I'm going to walk right up to the line. If you give me a line, I'm going to be right up to the edge of it. So, like, let's find those where it needs to be. So we learned right away from that, you know, experience to be much more direct with each other and early. So I started telling her, you know, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. Here's a sketch. Here's a whatever. And then she became, yeah, much more sort of in the moment tied to my actual process, which was hard for me, you know, because a lot of times you're making a picture, you don't know where it's going, really. You know, I often don't even tell the model what I'm up to. You know, I try to just follow it. So there was a lot of like, hey, Jen, I'm doing this. And then, you know, 3 days later, never mind, we're doing that. So that was absolutely new to me.
So what I love about what you're talking about, and this is something that I try to get people to understand about art and science, when you collaborate, you really were collaborating. It is often that the artist is, you know, at the behest of the scientist, or the scientist, you know, provides some science in something, you know, that becomes the subject matter for the artist. But in this case, you guys are really talking about what true collaboration would be. And that is a back and forth all the way through the process. Including having to throw out something that you really, really liked, both of you, but it just didn't fit within, for both of you, it didn't fit within what you were trying to do. Can you describe more? Have you collaborated before, or how did this feel?
No, this is my first time collaborating with Paul, and my first time collaborating with an artist, or someone outside of being a psychologist. And then I would say, like, in previous work, I've used, you know, kind of paintings, and paintings that, you know, a Mark Rothko or like a Pablo Picasso or different paintings I've pulled from, and, you know, and you're reading about, like, well, this is what the artist intended. Either they have documented that, or it's kind of written up. But in this case, it was really Paul, like, creating these paintings, you know, in the moment based on, like, our research question. Which was really, and really was that collaboration, the back and forth, but also like quite exciting because it had not been done before. We're relying on artworks where the artists are, you know, have passed away. So yeah, I don't know if you want to talk about that, Paul, more.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, there's no question what we're up to, right? We know what we're up to. We don't have to, you know, rely on Pablo Picasso's diary or something. Mm-hmm. You know, and these paintings are, yeah, they're made specifically for this purpose, right? And they're made in a way that, you know, this one fits with that one, right? One, you know, they're oriented this way, half of them oriented this way, half of them are oriented the other way, half of them are, you know, light, half of them are dark. There's this, you know, I don't know, concept album across the whole thing, which we developed together. And you know, like the one, I lost the first argument, right? But then there were others where, you know, for example, there was a particular expression I proposed, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm working this. And Jen didn't like it at first, didn't think it fit. And then to her credit, you know, went back, did her own research on what's going on in the body when, and came back with, yeah, thumbs up, by the way, you know, I wouldn't have done it that way, but you know, you're good to go on that one. So I won that one, you know? And I mean, just to say that too, personalities really matter, you know, a person's openness, you know, as a specialist to giving and taking is how this got done.
That's just really, go ahead.
I was going to add, Mark, too, is like a fine line too, because I wanted to like provide feedback, like, no, we can't use that painting, you know, that doesn't have a head. But it was also, you know, I wanted to be respectful, like, well, this is how, you know, this is what Paul, this is how he's expressing himself through his artwork. So I wanted to follow within the parameters of the study, but I also recognize that art, you know, I want artists have like the self-expression aspect of it. So it was kind of like, I was kind of balancing this fine line where I didn't want to say like, no, because I'm like, well, and that's with this one particular, you know, painting. I went back and I was like, oh, I did some research and I'm like, oh, this could be expressed this way. And I was like, okay, you know, kind of being open, you know, to this view, so.
That's just really exciting to hear that process. We've been talking with Paul Roots and Jen Drake about psychology and art and how those two might come together to collaborate. Join us for more conversation after this short break.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor, tune out all that noise, and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a wonderful conversation with Jen Drake and Paul Roots about a really unique collaboration between an artist and a developmental psychologist that resulted in helping you be not only collaborators, but Jen, you have some real science research questions. And so what were you really wanting to find out in this collaboration?
Right. And I'll say this is something that Paul and I think as we alluded to before, we, you know, we kind of went and read a lot and then came back together and developed these questions together. And so we were really, really looking at how, what emotions we experience when viewing art. And what we did is there are three ways to kind of express emotion through art. There's through these faces or bodies. There's through scenes and objects. And then there's non-representationally through kind of like color and line. And so we were looking at having these three different types of paintings or ways to express, means of expression. And then we were looking at, so what for each mean, so the faces, the scenes, and the abstract, Paul created works that were both positive and negative. So we were looking at, for example, we have in the faces, we have, you know, a painting where someone is expressing awe, or we have disgust. A person has like this disgusting face. And then I would say for like the scenes, the disgusting is like, she's like my word. I would cringe every time Paul would tell me this one, but it's like, cockroaches on top of cigarettes and a hot dog. It has a very visceral response to me. So that was our disgusting. And then the awe was, the earth and like rising, the earth and like, it was a really beautiful painting. So we had different ways of expressing these emotions. And so every time when people went through the survey that we would ask them, they would view this painting. And I would say, what are your positive experience of positive emotions? What's your experience of negative emotions? And so we hypothesized that when people were looking at these, you know, positive paintings, you know, the awe, the joy that we had, they would experience more positive emotions. But then when they looked at these negative paintings, the cockroaches and the disgusting and fearful paintings, that they would have this kind of mixed response, that they would both experience positive and negative emotions. And this is supported by some of the literature. There's a model developed by Menninghaus, and where he talks about this idea of distancing and embracing, that we, when we view a work of art that's negative, we kind of distance ourselves and then we from the negative art, and then we come to embrace it through our appreciation that art, that we can experience positive emotions when experiencing negative art. And that hasn't been looked at in the visual arts, but it's been looked at in film and in music, that we do like films that are sad because we get this experience of like enjoyment, or we have this kind of like vicarious response where we can experience, someone, a breakup or a death, but we don't actually experience it ourselves. We kind of have this distance from it that allows us to appreciate it. So that's in a nutshell what we were looking at, but I would say we haven't, data collection is ongoing, so hopefully we'll have results soon. Yeah.
Just anecdotally, I know it's not, you're not ready for that part of the research and haven't analyzed, but when you observed people just in general, did you notice any kind of mimicking or any kind of facial changes or things that you just would have thought or wouldn't have thought would be happening?
I would say I didn't. I mean, we didn't do any kind of like, that would be like EMG where you measure
people. Yeah, or just seeing them smile with it or try to move with it.
No, I didn't. I often watched people. I was only for the gallery that one day, or opening the gallery, but I watched people from behind. So I didn't actually see people's expressions. Paul, have you noted anything?
You noticed anything?
Yeah, and especially in conversations after the fact, there was a lot of that, and what Jen just said about, sad movies and so on. I mean, it seemed like that was really, really in effect, that, and especially that certain people had appreciation, especially for the level of craft on the negative ones. Then heightened emotion around them too, because, as Jen pointed out, wet cigarettes and cockroaches are disgusting to most of us. So it worked on that sort of, that horror movie kind of level, you're repulsed and entertained at the same time in that art as a safe place kind of thing. So people expressed that to me after the fact a lot. I actually, though, during made an effort not to be there. We had a gallery attendant who would basically know the kind of the quick script that we had, if people ran into trouble, which they often did, the lose the connection, whatever goes on, with the tech side, or those sorts of things. But yeah, I mean, in another way, this is another way that I had to embrace the strictures of science, and really and liked that challenge. Okay, this is art of a different kind, by kind of being the two bosses of this, from two different angles, Jen and I. We've created this choreographed experience for people, which is really neither mine nor hers. So I needed to respect, the mandate not to influence it with my person.
I just want to add too that we Paul graciously offered prints to like the first 100 participants. We had them all the studies. And I found surprisingly was on the gallery night is that people were really drawn to the negative prints. Those actually went first. That people, there were particular ones that they just really, really gravitated towards. Suggesting, I think, that even though it was depicting something, negative, people really liked it. Yeah.
And
I think that goes to like his policy, and like they appreciated and I know there's one in particular that's it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, fearful painting. And I think people were just really drawn to it. Yeah.
I think that there's a lot in there to be learned from displaying in a gallery and what you might want to put in juxtaposition. And it's interesting. I think one of the things that I was picking up on too, Jen, are you going to be able to, you got the reactions through survey, right? And also at the moment of doing it?
Yeah, so we,
how did you collect your data?
Yeah, so we it is that QR code. So as soon as people enter the gallery setting, they are doing it in the moment. Okay. And it is it's through Qualtrics, which is a software program. So I have access, you know, I can access it all the time. So I'm always texting Paul or emailing to update, like, we have this many participants, we're so close. And so yeah, so it is like real-time data that we're getting in right now. Yeah.
Any follow-up that you're gonna do? Do they, like, what I'm curious about as a museum professional is, did it spark conversations that went beyond their experience?
Oh, that's really interesting. We do ask, so I guess two parts. One is we do ask questions about how did this exhibit like affect you personally, you and your family, like in with your relationships, you think with your friends or like in the community at large. So we may be able to get at that a little bit. But one follow-up that we're interested in, depending on what our results are, is really looking at our experience, you know, because so much of or almost all of, you know, psychology of psych work is in the lab setting. We want to compare, like, what do we find in the gallery setting? And let's see what we find when we do this in an online survey. And like, what are we, you know, I assume, you know, we're all art, you know, obviously both an artist, a museum professional, I study the arts, we're all pro museum. I would be pro museum, but like, what do we gain from going to the, having these real works? And I think also demonstrating to the scientific community in the arts and psychology that we really need to move this stuff into the gallery setting, no matter, even though it may be really challenging and difficult, like there's something lost when we're showing them screens, you know?
Yeah. No, I agree. I think the holy grail that museum educators want is that continuing conversation. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about movies. We know that that's a part of the movie experience, right? It's the conversation at dinner afterwards or on the way home in the car, or, you know, after you experience dance, it's the same way, Paul. But I think with art, sometimes we get it, but sometimes we don't have much of that. You know, the experience, maybe it's so large in a gallery, we get more of the positive and negatives, but in this one, you got some real visceral reactions. And so it'd be really interesting to hear. I'd like to be the fly on the wall in their car, you know, and be able to hear what they say about what they saw in there and how it affected them beyond when they were at the exhibit itself.
Maybe you've given us an idea for a follow-up study.
It'd be a great study. It'd be very useful for museums, by the way.
No, definitely. I agree.
I think people don't feel empowered to talk about art, visual art, you know, and that's part of my motivation for doing this, you know, to say, listen, this is not about me telling you, you know, showing you what to think. I'm curious about what you think, right? So Jen and I have put together this thing. You walk in and you tell us what we've done. That's the job. That's your job as a viewer. And so we're prompting people to come up with, you know, phrases that they otherwise wouldn't in real time while they're looking at the imagery, so that they are, they're kind of priming themselves up to be the authority on what this means, on, you know, what's good in the room. And I think, we're much more used to doing that with the movies, you know, cause we're and with the visual arts for, I think a huge bunch of reasons we're less inclined to do that. And I think so from my perspective, by having to embrace those scientific, you know, strictures, you know, and I love talking, I love telling people what I think, it helps me have to, you know, foreground somebody else's point of view at all times.
Yeah.
And we were really clear on the instructions. Like there, we really put it in very bold letters. Like there are no wrong and right or right answers here. We're really interested in your response, your gut response. And I would say Paul was talking about phrases. He mentioned phrases for each painting. We also asked participants, in addition to how positive and negative emotions they experienced, we asked them to talk about like, what meaning do you make of this painting? And so they had to write like kind of a written response that we'll later code, looking at like kind of emotional words in those in there.
Yeah, but, and that's really interesting, that whole notion of making meaning, right? Mm-hmm. Something that that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. I think one of the other things that strikes me, and Paul, when you were talking about, when we look at dance and we look at even a symphony, or we may look at some of the other things that we can do, you know, a hands-on science museum or whatever, I think it might be part of our own trap in an art museum, you know, within the curatorial and the education staff, to put too many things there for us to have to read and attend to. And I don't mean that in a bad way, that reading's bad. What I mean is it doesn't allow you to control the experience. And what you've done with this is you're allowing that person to true, you're giving them permission to truly control the experience for themselves.
Yeah, there's that fine line, by making it a linear experience, right? You go to this one, then we're telling
you're
you to
controlling
go to that
part
one.
Of it.
We're making it, we're creating some extra strictures, right? Which, by the way, I don't see as that different from a lot of museum experiences, where you walk in and you've got your headphones and the thing, click on the deal.
That's right.
So in that way, it seems, ecologically valid. Is that the right term, Jen?
Yeah. Beautiful.
It's just super fascinating to me to then, to give people this mandate to tell us what we've done. And then they finish and they come over to me and they say, I don't know if I did this right, but this is what I saw. And it's like, of course you did it right. You did it your way, right? This is what we want. We want to know how a 65-year-old woman sees it. We want to see how a 19-year-old man sees it. We want to see how an Asian person sees it. We want to see how a European person sees it. We're interested in diversity in ways it's so hard to find, especially in, an art viewing community.
Yeah, and I wonder, Jen, in some of your work with children on things, do we, as we get older, do we begin to lose that freedom to say what we think? Honestly, I mean, are we looking for meta cues and, what the artist wanted us to think or that kind of thing? Where kids, I think, are much more forthcoming in what they see.
I mean, I would think so. I think like social pressure, kind of like conformity to like rules. Yeah. I can just say from like a drawing perspective that in the preschool years, children are very expressive in their drawings. They'll draw like green skies and like blue dogs, and they're very playful. And in some ways, like these kind of non-representational drawings, they look superficially similar to the works of like masters. And so they start off that way. And then around 7, 8, they start to learn like, no, this is how I draw a person, and they have these specific, shapes and everything. And no, the sky is only blue and dogs are only brown. And so they get very rule governed. And we kind of stay at that stage for many of us continue at that stage unless you become like maybe a professional artist, and then you become much more expressive and playful in your work. And so there is this kind of, we kind of go with rules and we think, well, this is how we're supposed to do things. But yeah, children start unfortunately very young doing that. Yeah.
Wow. That's really, this conversation just is a wonderful where we're able to go and think about, but it's got this added benefit, Jen, that you have the ability to do some really profound research on some ways that people come to view things that are art, and having it in a context that's not the clinical context, I think is powerful. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersection between art and science. We encourage you at home as a listener to have conversations about today's conversation and to explore with others any of the ideas that you are getting in your head right now. And we'll be right back.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation between Paul Root and Jennifer Drake. And, earlier on, we began that idea of thinking about collaboration and true collaboration and how really the sharing between a scientist and an artist can go back and forth. And I know in many universities and other places, they say, let's just throw the artists and scientists together and the collaboration will happen. And I know it never does. It does sometimes, but most of my own research has been that you have to do much more about it than that, and that they both have to enter into collaborating. So, Paul, you really wanted a collaborator that was in the other field. And so this is interesting. So a lot of artists don't really want one, but you did. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I'm just a collaborator. I don't believe in art as the, you know, the vision of one person fully formed coming at somebody. I don't know anybody. I mean, I'm in various critique groups, you know, and I don't know any poet, novelist, dancer, actor who works like that. You know, it always shifts because of your particular situation. And so I do seek people out who are going to challenge me, teach me, help me, you know, give me an opportunity to support them. So, you know, for years I worked with a sculptor and we did these installations where it was painting and sculpture. And we were having all sorts of different ways of changing the rules on each other between the different shows we did. Yeah, and that phrase, we kind of mentioned it earlier, right? True collaboration across art and science seems to be, you know, just a major phrase that I hear a lot lately, and the looking for it. And I, you know, so I have both a dance background, which, you know, when you put on a dance production, right, who's the visionary, even the choreographer who had the idea or puts that on the dancers, obviously, you know, depends on the dancers and the costumers and the lighting people and you know, the people making music, etc. You know, this is always a collaboration theater. I'm also a former naval officer, so I can do an operation. I can make logistics fit together a lot, and that I see that as normal. I see practical considerations as just part of it, no matter what we're up to. So it's not enough for me to talk about collaborating. We have to make the operation happen. So that was something that, you know, Jen and I were, I mean, Jen right away was like, what's your goal for this? You know, and I was like, well, you know, there's opportunity for funding here and then. And she cut to the quick right away. She said, I want to publish, you know, full stop. That was her goal. And I was like, Jen, I think this is going to be a true and beautiful collaboration. So that's, I don't know. Does that answer your question about collaboration?
Yeah. I mean, you really summed it up. And it was what I heard in there from both of you earlier and now is this idea that there was an openness to having your own direction change, at least an openness to having a conversation about that. And that, I think, is the significant difference between a collaboration and a true or open collaboration, one where there's that. And then the second thing you said, Paul, that I think is really critical and is very difficult for a lot of artists to do, and that is to say, I am actually going to do something. I mean, I'm going to finish it. It's not just an idea. In other words, the work may never be finished, but the idea is that I am still have a deadline. I'm still going to produce something.
Yeah, I love a good deadline. I really do.
I do.
And in fact, we, Jen and I got to talking and we went to our separate corners and did our reading and so on. And as it turned out, I had this show, which was delayed because of COVID anyway. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 1 year, everything was bumped back at the gallery where we ended up showing this thing. And it was, I was like, well, 12 paintings in 3 months, we could do this, you know, go hit the ground running. Right. And then, yeah, I have to put out a painting one painting per week. They're all 3 by 2 feet. So they are, you know, you're slinging a lot of paint. And then there's the added, you know, comedy. We tried to think of it as comedy, you know, between us of like, never mind, you got to start that over and all that. And so, you know, great challenges and that lovely thing that I think a lot of artists look for, flow. You know, I had no option except to get into flow for 3 months and throw everything I had at it. You know, every mode I've ever heard of to try to make a painting happen, right? Because we were doing, as Jen said, we were doing bodies, we were doing what we called metaphor paintings, right? So scenes, but not having people. And then we were doing full-on abstraction. I don't have a lot of experience showing abstractions. So those were a massive challenge to me, especially doing four different totally different abstractions, right? Totally different styles. Applying paint in ways that were unfamiliar to me. So the what do they call it? You know, the creative process, right? Was definitely lots of them, you know, and multiple different processes per day.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Jen, I know you've been wanting to ask a question about.
Oh, yes. I also want to say there was like the, what I think is also the openness that we both had really worked. I think our personalities kind of really meshed well, but I think also there was this dialogue and this and communication of constantly keeping each other in the loop in terms of like designing the study and then like Paul creating the paintings and like the setup. And so, and I would say that I think that Paul did a really wonderful job of always including me in, you know, and in, or updating me on his creative process. So I think that was really, and I will continue as I, once we're done with data collection, when we work on the analysis and the write-up, I will also include him. And I think that was, I think what, which has made this collaboration work is that we've been really in a nice communication and dialogue with each other. But I did want to ask, speaking of like the creative process, I really, because it was such a short time period that you had to create these, you know, 12 weeks, these 12 paintings. And I was just really curious, like, how did you go knowing that we were creating these, we had different emotions and different, like these different ways of expressing the emotion through the metaphors and the facial expressions and the the abstract works. How did you go about creating, like, let's say the joy or the fear or the disgust painting? So yeah. Knowing that you were working in different styles and some that were unfamiliar to you.
Oh, yeah. So right away, knowing that normally I do, I mean, I'm most familiar, most comfortable working with live people in the studio. So, okay, you know, we're going to start there as far as just actually applying paint to the particular canvases that I've prepped, you know? So I knew that I had some time to be doing what I'm most comfortable with, which is, you know, yeah, dealing with people, talking to them, you know, messing with lighting, whatever. And while I was doing that, yeah, and all the time off, it was try to figure out what happens if this paint does this, if I use a tube of paint I'm not used to, if I'm messing with it with a medium I'm not used to. You know, there were side experiments running all the time. A lot of looking around, wide open looking, going through all those art books you haven't looked at in 5 years, going back through the many sketchbooks, you artists, everyone, go back through old notes. There's good ideas in there, you know, cause I'm having ideas all the time. And it's a matter of just when is there time to do them? So some of the stuff came from there. I never let Jen know the most frustrating moments of all that. You know, the times when I was, you know, walking right toward despair of like, I thought I could do disgust. I had this grand plan and it fell apart. And Jen doesn't need to know that, you know. But then to take disgust the metaphor, or sorry, not the metaphor one, the abstract one, what I ended up doing with that was I took a big old leather glove and started finger painting, you know, goopy, big, thick impasto, and I'm not even going to use brushes, and we're going to let this thing be a total mess and try that a few times. And come up with our rules that way, you know? So sometimes there was, yes, my choreographic process, and I'm going to be super accurate with how I paint an eyeball. And then there's going to be, I have to become a person who doesn't care where this particular mark goes. And just trying to create circumstances where I can become a person comfortable with, you know, making those marks in different
ways. Did you find yourself being able to dance with your hand once you got into that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yes. And I think of that all the time. You know, I think of myself as, yeah, dancing while I'm painting.
Yeah, I'm thinking you put the glove on, that kind of took you out of your normal context. All of a sudden you've got this big, ugly kind of thing that's brutish. But it moves. And
yeah.
So it is coming out of you. It's just not, you know, cognitively coming out that I'm painting this. It's just your hands moving.
Yeah, I'm in acting. I'm certainly thinking about disgust. I'm looking at disgusting things. I'm listening to something nasty and go. And then throw that out and don't tell Jen, but try it 3 more times and come up with something that might be presentable. And now show, you know, Jen a JPEG of that disgust, you know.
Jen, have you seen any of those throwouts? those?
I have not. I'm really curious.
Okay. You still have any of the ones?
You saw some of them, didn't you?
I've only seen the headless one. No, I've only.
There were I'm thinking of Fear, especially Abstract Fear. I think you saw about.
I'll have to go back. Yes.
Because there were ones where I was like, "What do we think here?" And she'd be like, "Yeah, it looks good enough," you know. And then the next morning, I'd look at it and be like, "We can do better," and throw it out without even telling her, and then say, "By the way, we're going over this way." And she's like, "What happened to the other one?"
I didn't even remember. Yeah.
So, when does the study wrap up? It wraps up in the first part of 2022.
Yes, I think the closing date for the gallery is January 10th.
Okay. And then after that, you'll be obviously all the really other hard work, which is analyzing data
I would say like the front end, you know, when I was involved in that, but that was really his kind of getting those paintings. And then I'll be in the back end of, you know, kind of getting the data together, coding it, analyzing it, seeing what we have.
Do you have a target target for when you want to publish it?
I think that, you know, the publishing process is very long, but I hope that if we do have something promising, that we can submit it by the end of the spring to a journal. But I think, you know, and then that kind of varies how long it'll
go. I know it takes a while, but
so, yeah.
But I think getting to that point and getting it out there, that's really great.
Right. But I think we'll submit to conferences and things.
So yeah. And I think that's where you're going to get some of your most valuable feedback anyway.
I think so too. I think those are always lovely, having those one-on-one interactions as Paul had in the gallery, you know, getting people's feedback.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And Paul, what did you learn about yourself through this as an artist?
Oh my, great question. I have larger, wider capacity as a painter than I knew. This challenged me in directions I didn't foresee at all. It created problems that were, you know, immediate and needed to be solved. And through Jen's, you know, enormous help, I was able to make these pictures happen. I want to stress that too. The way that we set this up was that at no point was it one or the other, right? Or is it, you know, art or science, right? At the beginning, we are talking as artists and scientists. We might be reading, you know, studies, but we're certainly coming at it from that perspective. The production process was both of us, you know, needs were met in both ways, right? It has to hit these marks to be valuable scientifically. It has to not look terrible. It has to be presentable in a gallery, right? And it has to have, you know, a kind of unity. And as we move into the other side, it might be a little more difficult to do this part, but, you know, we're planning to write the thing together. And I personally, and Jen may completely disagree with this, but I see the paper, the scientific paper, as part of the art, as an art object, right? Because that's where we're presenting people's points of view about what we've done. That aggregate for me is the art. It's the study is this presentation of human beings' interaction with painting.
You just summarized why art and science, when done together well, is exactly what we should all be thinking about exploring, not that separation. I want to thank you, Paul, so much, and Jen. This has just been a really wonderful conversation. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore some of the curiosities in the intersections of both art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.